Welcome now to the midday for a Thursday. I'm Norman Gilliland, and Sarah Chang is here for her third visit. Hard to believe. Welcome to the midday.
Happy to be back. Thank you.
The previous one was 6 years ago today.
Was it?
Yeah, how about that? November 6, 2008, and then before that, back in 2004.
Very consistent. Wow.
Yeah, that's right. Well, happy to have you back.
Thank
and you're
you.
Here in town to perform with the Madison Symphony. It's what they call a Scandinavian concert, and it features Lyric Suite by Edvard Grieg, and it also features Carl Nielsen's Inextinguishable Symphony. And then the centerpiece would be a violin concerto, Sibelius. And,
yes.
You have not only played that, but recorded it as long ago as about 16 years ago.
That's true.
So that's a familiar piece for you.
It is a very good friend. It really is. It's one of my absolute favorite concertos of all time. And, I mean, the Sibelius, it's gorgeous. It's gorgeous. And it's really the best of everything that you can think of Scandinavia. Really, that the sort of Nordic, like, iciness,
yes,
you know?
Yes, he was good at that.
And the incredible drama that boils underneath every single note. I mean, it is an incredibly dramatic concerto and loads of fun to play. And it's a great program. The entire program is going to be fantastic.
So. It's interesting with violin concertos that there are, you know, if you look at the 19th, early 20th century, there are several major composers who wrote just one violin concerto.
Right.
You have, you know, Tchaikovsky. You have, of course, earlier you have Beethoven.
Brahms wrote one as well.
And then Sibelius, among others. Is there any kind of, as a violinist, I realize you've been playing this stuff since you were about, you know, 5 years old when you first performed and got into Juilliard. But is there a progression in these concertos in terms of the way a performer would take them on?
There was for me. And I'm sure, you know, everyone sort of matures at their own speed. And, you know, everybody has a sort of, I think, a natural sort of pull towards what composer, like which composers, what sorts, you know, what sort of style suits their character as well. And, you know, as a student, you learn everything. And I remember when I first learned the Sibelius, I wanted to start playing it immediately. Like, immediately.
Okay,
I wanted to go on stage.
You were how old?
I think I was 7 the first time I performed it in public. I was 7, and I learned it, and I just loved it so much. And what's really interesting about the piece is that, you know, with some other composers, you sort of have this love-hate thing, you know, where you learn it, you play it, you know, like you play it to death and then you get tired of it and you put it away for a while and then maybe, you know, 2 years later, 5 years later, you bring it back out and then hopefully you fall in love with it again.
Right,
but with the Sibelius, for me, it's been consistent. It's been one of those really, really trusted friends that, like, from the time I was 7, I've always had this love affair with the Sibelius, and it's so close to my heart. And I've got a lot of sentimental attachment to it because it was also you know, something that I recorded when I was quite young with the Berlin Philharmonic and Marius Janssen's conducting. And it's one of those things that goes straight to your heart. And for me, it's been one of my favorites from the time I was very young.
And we'll hear some of that recording a little later during this hour, too. But it's the, do you have this sort of gray Nordic side to you?
I'm not sure if I have any Nordic blood in me at all. I'm not sure about that. But, you know, I do go to Scandinavia a lot and I perform there quite a bit. And I mean, Sibelius is, until recently, you know, because I've gone to Finland loads of times and I think they've changed their currency now. But until a few years ago, Sibelius was actually on their 20, not dollars, because they never, I think it was kroners at the time or whatnot, but on their 20 kroner note, like the actual bill, like Sibelius was on the bill. And I still, to this day, I can't think of a single composer who's on a monetary currency, you know?
Well, so now with the euro, it's going to be harder to find.
Exactly. But, I mean, there's a huge amount of pride there, obviously, because Sibelius was like a national hero for them.
Sure.
And, you know, it was one of those things where, you know, sometimes you go to a big city, and especially in Europe, you know, you've got all these European composers who are from these great cities.
Yes.
And sometimes you pass their home, sometimes you, you know, pass places where they went to school, and there's a little plaque, and, you know, sometimes you're interested and sometimes you're not, to be honest, because you want to hit the shops or you want to go, you know, to a restaurant or whatnot.
Oh, another composer.
I know, right? But for me, Sibelius was one of those people that I truly respected so much that The first time I went to Finland and I went to Helsinki, I asked if I could go visit his home, which was actually closed for those 6 months during the winter because the winters there are so harsh. And it was a place called Ainola, which was quite a bit of a drive away from Helsinki. But my manager took me there and she made some phone calls and they very, very kindly opened the home so I could take a look. And I got to go and like play on his old piano, which I don't think I was supposed to do that, but we were there anyway. So
maybe it was in tune. It was probably
you know. And he's also buried there, and it was very, very touching for me, you know, just to sort of walk in his home and just get a feel of the man and the place. And you know, it's one of those things where you know you want to play, you know, you want to pay tribute to someone that you respect so much.
Well, more about Sibelius later. He had a very interesting and somewhat, I guess you could say, lopsided career. But maybe on the other side, or 90 degrees away from the Nordic bleakness, we have one of your early recordings. Let's see, 1997, fairly early, and of the Dance of the Goblins. It's, you know, only, what, not even a week past Halloween, so
exactly.
It's not at all too late for this. It's a Scherzo Fantastique by Antonio Bazzini, and your pianist here is Charles Abramovich.
Yes, perfect.
And so, and this piece turns up occasionally in the repertoire, and what makes it appealing to you?
It's a fun piece. It's a fun piece, and it's very much of a firework piece. You know, a lot going on the left hand, and it's very, very technical. But from beginning to end, it's one of those pieces that you need to sort of toss off as being a bonbon sort of show piece. So that's
encore kind of thing.
Encore kind of thing, but it's actually a lot of work. So yeah, it's the best of both worlds.
And the kind of thing, of course, audiences love is it's a kind of a showstopper. So here it is. This is the Dance of the Goblins. By the way, it's the first piece on the CD that was released back in 1997, featuring Sarah Chang and Charles Abramovich. Was it as much fun for you to listen to it as it was for all of us to listen to it? After how long has it been? 17 years?
Yeah, no, not really. No, it's that kind of thing, right? If you listen to yourself, it's kind of like looking at like old baby photos of yourself.
Well, we'll get even closer to that in a minute here. Since your recording history goes so far back.
I have celebrated, I think, over 20 years with EMI. You know,
I would say,
and
so. Yes,
yeah, because, and it's. I think for anyone in the music business, you know, that's one of the things that I'm most proudest of. I'm with the same company
quite
that I started
out
with.
EMI, and of course, one of the most prestigious labels too. Yeah, and it's actually 22 years, according to this one we have here.
No, we've done well together.
So time does fly, but that's a lot of discs too over that course of time. And my guest today is Sarah Chang. We're listening to her CDs, and of course we'll have the quiz question in about 11 minutes, and remind you that she is going to be performing with the Madison Symphony this weekend. Back with Sarah Chang, and we're speaking of baby pictures. We're going to go there now. But really, how impressive to have, in effect, a baby picture taken, you know, with members of distinguished musical ensembles. And this is your debut CD from back in 1992. You were admitted to Juilliard at the age of 5 and started playing with major orchestras, what, by the age of 7 or so?
Yeah, something like that.
I want to say, is that cruel and unusual punishment for a 7-year-old?
I don't know.
Very intense life even for an adult.
I don't know. It's gone by very, very quickly. And the thing is that when you start out so young, you don't realize how incredibly lucky you are, you know, because I was growing up with Zubin Mehta and Kurt Mazur and Yo-Yo Ma, and I thought this was normal, you know, and then, you know, it takes a few years before you realize, no, actually, it's not normal to play with these people every single night.
Even as an adult.
Because these are, like, these are the great maestros of our generation, and I just, you know, just incredibly fortunately happened to start out really early and to grow up with people like Isaac Stern as my musical godfather, and to have, you know, Pingo Zuckerman and just all these amazing musicians just giving you advice and life advice and career advice and violin advice and just being a part of your life. I mean, that's incredible. And for me, you know, I credit my parents, you know, for having put me in a normal school as well as Juilliard, because they didn't want me to get like a huge head. And
this was Philadelphia?
I was born in Philadelphia. I always lived in Philly, you know, even when I was at Juilliard, you know. I mean, home was always Philly. And, you know, I would go to Juilliard, but it wasn't every day. You know, they would put me in a normal private school. So I would get my normal education with kids my own age. And then Juilliard was, you know, on the other days and with students twice my age, if not three times my age. And unbelievably talented musicians and colleagues, and to be in that sort of environment was very, very motivating and, you know, somewhat competitive, but it drives you in the right way because Juilliard is a fantastic school and I had the most amazing teachers there.
So the school that you attended in Philly,
yes,
did they have a music program?
They had a generic sort of music program, you know, and I think once you got into middle school, I think that's when they they had a school orchestra, you know.
This is what I'm going to ask.
I was not required to be in school orchestra, no. I think they figured that my Juilliard education was, you know, good enough credit, you know. But, I did go to a private school there, and they did have, you know, thankfully a music program, you know, where they had band and, of course, you know, orchestra, and kids were, you know, given a choice to choose an instrument. And no, I think, you know, the whole, you know, music education, you know, thing is, of course, a concern for everybody.
It is.
You know?
Yes.
And the U.S. Embassy, very generously about 3 years ago, gave me the title of an artistic ambassador. And what that entails is a focus on musical education for children, not just children who are already driven and in schools like Juilliard and Curtis and already know that they want to pursue music, but also children in underprivileged
areas. Sure. And there's so much talent that gets discovered out there in unexpected places.
Exactly. And they've sent me everywhere from, you know, all the states in the U.S., obviously, but, you know, to places in war-torn Serbia, to South Africa last year, and just going into places where students, kids, really, they might not even know what a violin is, you know, and just going there and playing for them. And, you know, and if I can't go into the schools, then busing them into the concert hall so they can see what an open rehearsal is like and giving them the chance just to take a peek at what the behind the scenes, you know, the whole situation is, and just musical exposure, you know, that's all. I mean, I'm a musician, I'm not a politician, so all I can do really is just play and, you know, hopefully, you know, expose the kids to as much music as possible.
All right, speaking of kids, here's one that's going to play some Chopin. And obviously it's an arrangement because the nocturnes of Chopin for piano solo, but many of his piano solo pieces have really sung in violin and piano arrangements.
Such an exceptional composer who didn't write anything for the violin. You know?
I mean, figure. That's true.
Go figure.
Yeah.
So, I mean, the nocturnes, that's the piece we're going to play is an arrangement that Nathan Milstein transcribed, you know, because it's such a gorgeous nocturne, but he really didn't write anything for the violin, so.
Well, fortunately, you have this transcription to work with here, and in this case, your pianist is Sandra Rivers. This is the Nocturne No. 10 in C-sharp minor by Chopin, the violinist. My guest today, Sarah Chang.
Thank you.
provides an interesting angle on what originally was a piano solo piece by Chopin. That was his Nocturne number 10, and Nocturne number 10 in C sharp minor, played by Sarah Chang, and pianist Sandra Rivers. And I always have to ask, you know, so after 22 years, what's it like confronting yourself as you were that back then?
It makes me sound really old. No, you know what it is? There are parts of me that are really proud, you know, of the things that I did as a child. And there are also things that I want to go back into the studio and re-record. So.
Yeah, but I mean, do you think there's something that that you would miss in a performance of a child if you were to re-record it as, you know, as an adult?
Yeah, I think that's very, very true. I think there's a certain innocence mm-hmm. and a certain freshness when mm-hmm. you're that young, and everything is just so fun and exciting because this was my first recording, you know? And I mean, I was on cloud nine. I mean, working with all these producers and engineers and all these record executives and management, and it was a lot going on for a 9-year-old back then. And to be making a recording and then going into the studio and then doing a photo shoot and all that's very, very exciting. And you get to miss school during all of that, so that's awesome too. And you know, and in the middle of that, you know, I just listening to that though, I'm very, very grateful and really impressed with what the sound engineers did, because I was using a quarter size violin for that.
Well, yeah, that's another thing I wondered about. You started on a 16th size.
I started because I was 4 years old when I started, and it was a 16th size violin, which is essentially like a Christmas ornament. You know, it's a toy. It's a toy. And, you know, by the time I was 9, you know, I was a small kid with small hands, and I was using only a quarter size. And I remember having this discussion, you know, and this was a serious discussion.
About pitch?
About not just pitch, but the quality of the instrument.
Oh,
because
I had
a really, really good quarter-size violin, you know, from London. It came mm-hmm. from London, from Charlesbury in London. And I remember sitting down, you know, at the EMI office with, like, my management, my teacher, and my parents, and the record executives, and the producer, and the sound engineer. It was a huge conference room. And I don't really know what a 9-year-old was doing in a conference room. But anyway, I was there. And they were saying that they've never recorded on a quarter size violin before, and like we would need to spend time with the mics and the sound system just to figure out how this is going to work. And I actually think it was in the Guinness Book of World Records.
Oh, really?
Yeah, as like the smallest violin ever recorded or something silly like that.
I'm not sure.
Yeah. But you know, it was. You know, they did a beautiful job.
I would say so. Yeah, this is a whole CD of this. It's not just one.
Yeah, and the thing is that now I do have an exceptional instrument that I'm very, very lucky to have my hands on. I now use a Guarneri Del Gesù, you know, that was made in 1717. And it should be in a museum, you know, but
well,
I'm traveling with
yes
it.
Yes and no, but I mean,
yes
if it's
and
in
no.
a museum,
I mean,
nobody gets to hear it, and it just kind of
that's true.
Tightens up, right?
For preservation, you know, purposes, it should be a museum. But then again, as an instrument, it should be out being heard, you know, on stage, you know, in concert halls.
Don't they just hold up better if they're
exactly.
played?
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. So, and of course, you know, we go through security at every airport, and they always want to know what's inside the violin case. So yeah, I don't know if that's exactly what Guarneri had in mind when he made it, but you know, I got it from Isaac Stern when I was 14 years old.
Wow.
And he was my mentor, and he was like my musical godfather. So to be able to play on this instrument every day is just such an honor for me, and just has a lot of sentimental value. And you know, to be able to have an awesome instrument like that now, but then to go back and to listen to, you know, a disc that I did when I was 9 years old on a quarter size violin, you know, it brings back a lot of great memories.
I would think so, sure. And how nice to have that CD that you can return to from time to time to encounter your younger self.
Oh, believe me, I don't listen to myself when I don't have to.
Maybe we'll get into that a little later too. Well, Sarah Chang is here, as you may know, to perform with the Madison Symphony. The three concerts, Friday night at 7:30. That's tomorrow night already.
Yes.
Saturday night at 8, and then Sunday afternoon at 2:30. It's a concert of Scandinavian music, including Sibelius, and the violin concerto. And it seemed appropriate to hear. It was one of your still pretty early recordings of this concerto. It takes us back 16 years now. Concert recording, too.
Yes. It was taken from a live concert in Berlin with the Berlin Philharmonic. And by that, it basically means, you know, we had two concerts. They ran tape. on the two concerts, and that was it.
That was it.
Really. You edit between the two concerts, and that's all you get. you get two shots at it.
Well, it does add an extra layer of excitement, doesn't it?
Yeah, a huge amount of excitement, and also it also means, you know, coughs and audience, candy wrappers and programs.
Oh, yes.
And it adds another dimension. It's a lot of fun.
Classical concerts, for whatever reason, this is somebody's dissertation topic, I'm sure, have more coughing than any other kind of concert. I'm not kidding. If you go to any other kind of concert, people just don't cough as much as they do. But in between movements in a classical concert, it's like suddenly you're in, you know, General Hospital. I'm not sure why that is.
I don't know.
But at least most of the time they avoid coughing during the music. And so this is the finale, and pretty much nonstop for the violinist, isn't it?
Absolutely.
You're performing here with the Berlin Philharmonic. Marius Janssen's conducting. Belong to people listening to a concert of the Berlin Philharmonic back in 1998, or perhaps even a little earlier. Marius Janssens was the conductor and the violinist there with the finale of Sibelius's violin concerto, Sarah Chang, and she is in Wisconsin to perform that same concerto with the Madison Symphony this weekend. Back now with Sarah Chang and the name of the person sometimes said to be the greatest violinist who ever lived. The critics said of him that he plays the violin as well as the instrument could even be played. Mm-hmm. And fortunately, Paganini actually wrote a fair amount of stuff and left it too. So, including some wonderful melodies, you know, Italian melodies in some of the smaller pieces. You have a cantabile that is pretty typical Paganini, I would guess.
Exactly. I mean, he wrote his concertos for the violin. He wrote all those 24 caprices.
Sure, the solo caprices.
You know, which are all, every single one of them is a monster on its own.
Is that right?
Yeah. And, you know, and these little, you know, gem, you know, jewels of show pieces. And he wrote quite a few of them. And the cantabile is one of, you know, the prettiest things that he wrote.
And he wrote a fair amount of violin and guitar music, too.
He did. And this cantabile, actually, I have performed with the guitarist instead of a pianist, you know, before, and it works beautifully. This recording, though, was with the pianist because it's just easier to find a pianist than it is to find a guitarist.
Who can play for the Paganini.
Exactly.
Yeah. So here, this is from 1996, Sarah Chang, and brings back pianist Charles Abramovich with this cantabile in D by Paganini. Have you recorded or performed any of those Paganini violin concertos?
I have. I recorded the first concerto.
The first one?
Mm-hmm. The first concerto with the Philadelphia Orchestra and Maestro Sabalic. And I think some of the caprices as well is on the debut disc.
Are those crazy difficult, those Paganini violin concertos?
They are, but not more or less so than, you know, some of the other concertos
really?
That we hear.
Because he had such a reputation. Of course, he would do some kind of exotic things with tunings too, didn't he?
Yeah, but here's the thing, though. I mean, yes, they're difficult, but he was a violinist, so he understood the instrument. So everything sits well in the fingers once you get the work done. I think usually, you know, the problems, the real problems, I think, if, at least for me, come from when, you know, composers who are not violinists try to write for the instrument, and it's just apparent just from looking at the score that they just did not know the instrument, you know, that they could have been incredibly talented composers who wrote well but just didn't understand the instrument. And that happens, you know, often.
Does it really?
It does happen. And then I think the smart ones, though, like Brahms and Bruch and these composers
really
who did not,
they
collaborated with violinists. They understood what where their strengths and where their weaknesses were, and they enlisted the help of, like, you know, Joachim, who was well known at the time for for, you know, being essentially the right hand man.
Sarasate, another one.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. So I think the smart composers who understood their weaknesses, you know, enlisted the help of friends or, you know, the violinist of that generation to help with the technical aspects. And I think in that sort of way, you know, Paganini, although his work is difficult, since he understood the instrument really well,
you know,
everything, it helps, and it sits in the fingers very well.
Have you commissioned works then? You must have.
I have.
Mm-hmm.
I have.
And how did that work? Was that a collaborative process, or was you look at the page and say, yike, this should have been done for
It's gone both ways. It has gone both ways. I've commissioned a few pieces, and there have been times when I have gone yikes, and there have been times when one of my favorite composers right now is Christopher Theofanidis, and he wrote a concerto for me, and that was a year of really hands-on collaborating where he would write, you know, material and send it to me, and I would be in a hotel room in Paris, and I would have him on speakerphone, and I'd play passages, and it really was a collaborative effort where he was so understanding, and, you know, it really sort of, I have so much respect for composers, and it fascinates me the way that they think and the way that they create music. And I mean, after working with Christopher, it totally whet my appetite for wanting to work more often with living composers.
Well, let's close with this favorite, short but favorite piece by, it's usually get double credit, Grigorijus Dinichiu, and then Jascha Heifetz, who kind of discovered and reworked this piece, I guess.
Exactly.
The Hora Staccato, and this brings back the pianist Charles Abramovich with my guest today, violinist Sarah Chang. Well, that was fun. Is that a piece that you play often?
Occasionally for encores, and it's a fun piece that's sort of familiar with people who aren't even, you know, musicians.
I would guess so.
Yeah.
It's kind of an interesting story behind that. Every now and then, there's one of these pieces that a composer will come across, somebody, you know, they've never heard of the composer. Well, to some extent, Brahms with the Hungarian Dances, you know, just settings of things that were in the air at the time, and he turns them into a piece of music.
Little jewels, right?
Yeah. Right. So you're off to some other exotic place after.
I am in Europe for the next about month.
Okay.
Or so, yeah. Germany and Spain, and it's always on tour.
I'm sure you have a list somewhere.
I'll be home for Christmas and
back in Philly.
Back in Philly, and I'm going to do nothing. I'm going to eat everything in sight. I'm going to watch bad, trashy TV. I'm going to go play with my puppy that I just got a puppy, and he's like the love of my life right now and the master of my universe, and he runs the house.
That sounds fantastic.
Yeah, so.
Well, thanks for stopping by.
Thank you.
Thanks
for having me.
Look forward to your next visit.
Thank you.